action.
Hello.
Hello.
Excellent. Good
Hello.
Evening, Evan. How are you doing?
I'm good. Adam, how are you?
Very well.
So cool. Well, welcome to another episode of Myth Makers.
Yes.
This is a show about storytelling, the process, people, and power of story.
Mm-hmm.
It is often about us.
Yes.
Adam Martin.
Accidentally.
And
yes, Evan Matthews.
Yep. We are M2, and ultimately this show is really about the work that's being done in every medium to thrill us, make us think, and ultimately move us in ways that are exciting in regards to story and the process of storytelling.
I like that. You came up with that this week.
I did.
You yes. did. I've been pondering that.
I've been pondering that, yes. So, you know, it's important to say, like, what are you actually listening to or watching?
Oh, why? Exactly.
Exactly. So, you know, I think, before we jump into this week's updates and topics, I also wanted just a slight correction from last week.
Mm-hmm.
We mistakenly said that last week's episode was number 45. It
yes.
was actually 44.
Oh, dear.
So this is
45. Yes.
So welcome to episode 45 of Myth Makers.
Welcome to the presidential
yes.
episode.
Yes, the presidential episode. Exactly. So how was your week this week?
My week was good. Very busy
yep.
with the show.
Shooting Future Man.
Shooting Future yep. Man for Hulu.
Yep.
Season 2. Lots of stuff. Monday was amazing. This big kind of fight sequence, crowd kind of fight sequence. 57 setups in one day,
which was amazing,
in like 11 and a half hours,
and
which
so
is
just
incredible.
For anyone that doesn't know, define a setup for in the film world.
In the film world, so a setup is literally any kind of one identifiable camera position.
Yes.
So if the two of us are sitting talking on the sofa and you're shooting it, then the setups will traditionally be a kind of two-shot from out here,
mm-hmm.
very much as you're seeing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then there'd be some kind of raking overs in this situation, which would be raking meaning from one person to another.
Yes.
So raking as opposed to kind of a single and a single, it's a raking over would be kind of, Evan's rake would be over me onto him and then vice versa the
yes.
other way. And so, you know, typically speaking, you're getting on a TV show, you're getting somewhere between 20 and 30 setups a day,
mm-hmm.
Depending on complexity, obviously.
Yes. So 57 would be a big number.
That's
yes.
a high day. Yeah. I've done as low as kind of 3 on commercials
yes.
when you're being very, very precise about
yes.
everything. And, up to kind of, you know, big days on, I think probably Transformers was, you know, similar numbers, 55 to 60 on
yeah.
the big action days. And admittedly, you're using 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 cameras. And so each of those camera positions is a setup.
Yeah.
So those numbers get inflated on big days,
mm-hmm.
because you have large numbers of people. We had 3 cameras running with us and it was a blast. It was just
yes.
great. You get this kind of, adrenaline. We have 100+ extras on stage. We had lots of actors. We had a fight. We had it was awesome.
That's awesome.
It was really, really cool. So yeah, it was a lot of fun. There's
yes.
an energy that gets created around that stuff. That's
yes.
great.
So without spoiling anything, I think it's safe to say that the little bits and pieces that you've shared and that I may have seen, Future Man Season 2 is
yes.
looking really.
It's great.
Fantastic.
It's going to be yeah. really, really good. Yes, I
yeah.
just, I, it's, of all the shows I've done, I think it's, I love it. It's,
yeah.
It's my favorite. It's great.
That's very
yes.
cool.
Very,
I love
very
it.
Cool. Yes.
That's awesome.
How's your week been?
It's been good. So, we've teased this a bunch. We're going to tease it again, I think, for the last time this week. But, been ironing out final details on a pretty big deal that we've been working on putting together. And then, while that's been going in the background, also doing some animation this week.
Yep.
So, the limit.
Great stuff.
It's very fun, actually.
Very cool.
And then also prepping the final bits and pieces for the new launch of Dead Town on the Yarn
yes.
platform. So we'll have, again, sort of an official announcement about that. Should be in next week's show.
Yep.
But what's been fun, and actually is not our topic for this evening, but just a quick side topic. For any of you out there, and we hope it's a lot of you that are actually making your own stuff, you know, it's important to think about, at least in my opinion, it's important to think about and ultimately to participate in as much as you're able the marketing component of that stuff. And so, you know, it's a good example where, you know, we're working with this, you know, great company, Mammoth Media, the great platform that we really like, Yarn. And, you know, they've got a really great team of people there, from the story people to the marketing people
yep.
to their designers, all that stuff. And yet, you know, one of the things that I think made our initial launch of Dead Town successful on Yarn was the fact that we brought our own marketing pieces to it.
Interesting. So, yes.
You know, in fact, we got that feedback from them that, you know, one of the things that they felt helped with the kind of building of that audience was the fact that our cover art, our mm-hmm. you know, things that were actually used to promote the material were on the platform
very good.
Were yeah. good and distinctive. And so, right. you know, who else knows better kind of how to represent your stuff than the creator of that stuff? And yes. of course, you know, we want, and you should want, you know, the feedback from the people that know the home that it's going to live on. But I think we're able to bring something to that, you know, mm-hmm. not that they aren't talented, but that we can kind of bring our own perspective on our own story yes. to it. Yes. And I'm really happy with some of the pieces that we put together.
Very, very good.
And, you know, some of the stuff that we're able to kind of do with them to you know, promote that material as it launches.
Yeah. So it's going to be exciting to see that kind of going live, we think, in the next yeah. kind of 10 days.
We've been delivering those kind of final marketing assets, you know, working with them on final bits and pieces. Also, you know, as a side note, you know, one of the things that we're doing with them is, you know, for anyone that doesn't know, our Dead Town main series is running on our own comics platform, which is called Macroverse. So mm-hmm. go download that right now. Pause and go download. Yep, then come back.
Exactly.
And season 9 is coming very soon. Or not season 9. Episode 9 is coming very soon. Which will complete season 1 of Dead Town on Macroverse. And there is a sort of subtle tie-in between the two, which will become clearer and clearer as the universe develops.
Yes.
Exactly. So as that's getting wrapped up, and then kind of working with Steven, who's the artist on both projects, to, you know, kind of build out all those bits and pieces, we're also building promotional material that kind of lets the audience kind of move back and forth between the two platforms. And yes. so all that stuff is sort of, you know, an interesting and I think important, actually very important piece of, you know, developing something, especially that lives in a multi-platform
yes.
Context. So, you know, that's been a big part of the week as well.
It obviously helps enormously. We've got yeah. Stephen Perkins doing kind of everything for everything,
yes.
which is great.
Exactly.
So there's just very directly, there's a
visual connection for sure.
Fantastic. Continuity there is enormous.
Yeah, exactly. And he's just awesome. And anyway.
He's amazing.
So
yeah,
shout out to Steve.
Yep.
So that's been a big part of my week. And then also, you know, this stuff that we've been working on as far as continuing to break story and now getting mm-hmm. into the production piece or the pre-production
yes.
piece of, you know, figuring out what are we shooting and where are we shooting it.
Exactly.
And
all that fun stuff. So this, we started a lot of time today doing that.
Yeah.
And that's going to become more and more, like, once the deal's in place, that's the next big yep. piece of it that
exactly.
kind of kicks in. Casting being a huge part of it,
yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's interesting, yeah, we've talked about casting before, but mm-hmm. it's such a crucial piece.
And
down to
kind of
the one-line roles that you get yes. and how they are played. And, you know, the kind of one-line, poorly delivered in the middle of an otherwise excellent scene
yes.
blows
and
the scene.
Totally
and,
yeah.
So exactly. That's always fun. I love the casting process.
And it's one of the things I think, you know, and this is, we'll either be prophetic or eating these words, but I I think it's one of the things that, you know, we are able to bring to this project is actually a good, both kind of network and also a good sense for
yes,
you know, casting
for
and kind
sure.
of putting
sure,
those pieces
sure.
together. So lots of exciting stuff on
yep.
the way. Can't wait to share more about it. In the meantime, let's talk about this week's topic,
yes.
which Adam suggested and I think is fantastic, which is in any storytelling scenario, whether that's for comics or live action or something like
anything.
The Yarn platform,
yeah.
really any story that you're telling, especially any fictional story that you're telling,
yes.
You know, we're talking about how do you build tension and kind of continue to just up the stakes for right. your characters and for the story and the plot as it moves
right.
along.
And so, therefore, obviously, for the audience's kind of engagement in
exactly.
that story.
Exactly. Yes. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, very specifically, we looked at... So I saw the new Jurassic Park yesterday.
Not me. So spoilers for everyone that hasn't seen it, including this guy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So my son saw it opening weekend and came home and said... My 10-year-old came home and said... It was fine, but the script wasn't great. And the actual, like, you little fucking Hollywood kid. Well, feeling immensely
yes,
proud.
Yes,
of course.
Exactly.
So I was like, oh, but yeah, okay, great.
Yeah.
This is good.
The child of someone that works in
exactly,
the film business.
Exactly. Who loves, you know, dude, it's very funny. He's, you know, we get all the, it's a total side note, but we get all the Oscar screeners for the Directors Guild come through. And so, you know, we watch basically all the Oscar nominated movies at Christmas. And I think that's, it's quite often there's stuff, topics that are a little advanced in there, but it's also kind of great to sit there and watch a drama with a 10-year-old and realize they feel they're getting something out of it.
Yes.
And I'd say one of his, it's funny, one of his favorite movies is The Theory of Everything, Stephen Hawking, you know, thing, which is kind of intense and sad and challenging, and it's great. So when he comes home and says that kind of thing, he's generally right. He'll, you know, thoroughly enjoys it, obviously. And, you know, gigantic dinosaurs stepping on people is
never a bad thing.
But very specifically, we're looking at this and having seen it again. Now, having seen it, sorry, he saw it again, and then I saw it for the first time yesterday. And, it, you know, some terrific sequences. A.J. Bayona is the director, who had done Monster Calls before, which actually I didn't love as a movie. But, you know, he's able to construct some very good sequences and certainly had me kind of jumping out of my skin a few times, which was great. But having said that, I'm a complete wimp when it comes to those things. While structurally the story overall, there were just gaping holes in it and weird tonal shifts in the middle of scenes where they suddenly go from comedic to dramatic and they're trying to kind of force drama on you. And one of the major ways they do this is the classic kind of kid in peril scenario.
Right.
Little girl, granddaughter, sensibly granddaughter of the main, kind of one of the architects of Jurassic World.
Yes.
Who is running around. And of course, she's the one that the villainous kind of prototype dinosaur, which is another inherent issue with the movie because, like, okay, you did the fabricated dinosaur before and now you're doing an even bigger, badder fabricated dinosaur this time.
Because it worked out so well the first time.
Like, that's, you can feel the exec sitting around like, oh great, you know what, let's amp it up, let's take that concept and turn it up to 11. You kind of did that before rather well actually, and let's not do that again, let's find out, you know. Side note, I think that's a future discussion. But so, they did have a little girl running around screaming and being needing to be rescued, and well, it can work incredibly well because that immediately, it gives, you know, any parent immediately, of course, that wraps up the tension for you. And so generally speaking, when it's done well, that's a very, very effective way of raising the stakes of the characters. However, when you don't really care about the kid involved,
it
is not nearly as effective.
Yeah.
And that was just very, it was very interesting seeing how it was such a clear, because obviously they avoided the child in peril thing in the last Jurassic World.
Yes, yeah.
Thank God, because you didn't need it.
Yes.
Whereas you felt like, oh, this is a clear play. It was, if you're kind of the creation of this project by committee, and like, well, great, let's add this ingredient in here because that will help.
Yes.
Which is kind of irritating.
So, I mean, it's interesting. So, I mean, just kind of tracking back to basics for a second. So, I think what we're going to talk about it in the context of kind of Kids in Peril, because I think it's a good one in the sense that both can work incredibly well and is also, I think, at this point kind of become sort of an easy trope to grab onto.
Yes.
Which makes it also very possible to work incredibly not well.
Right, exactly.
Or to be ineffective. And so it's the, you know, kind of fundamentally, what are the things that, you know, kind of keep an audience engaged and that keep people wanting to kind of continuing. You know, one of the things that we found with writing both for Yarn and for Macroverse is, you know, both of those formats tend to be kind of shorter form. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're both intentionally designed to be sort of these bite-sized pieces of content. And so we're always kind of thinking about, you know, what's the little cliffhanger, what's the little thing that's gonna, you know, kind of
keep you engaged,
to keep going in the story. And so I think, you know, part of the kind of structural component of that is like thinking about, you know, from the character point of view, from the plot point of view, you know, what are the things that are going to happen both from a you know, A to B to C plot construction, and then more importantly, you know, how do the characters drive that plot?
Right.
And exactly. Then how does that, you know, kind of up the tension. And so, you know, one of the things that can work very effectively is, you know, giving your kind of main character or your, you know, your lead most of the time.
Yes.
You know, something that they care about.
Yes.
That they feel compelled to, you know, protect, to, you know, get in the way of, to, you know, kind of make sure, you know, comes through okay, which often a kid is sort of an easy way to,
yes,
to kind of engage that, or to, you know, again, sort of, you know, you almost can take a shorthand to go like, okay, generally we all agree that kids should not be eaten by dinosaurs. Right. So let's give this person something to take care of. And so we were kind of talking before we started recording about, you know, what are some examples of where that has worked really well.
Yes.
And actually the first Jurassic Park is a good example.
Did a very good job of that, obviously.
And then tracking back, the first one that I could remember, and then Adam thought of an even earlier one, but the first one I could remember is Newt in Aliens.
Yes.
And what's interesting, and actually, you know, be interesting to, I haven't seen Aliens in a little while, but you know, it's like, I don't think my memory of it is that Newt is not, there's not a lot of time setting up her as a character.
No.
But something about her performance, the way that it's delivered, the interactions that she has with Ripley,
yes,
feel so genuine. And I think part of that actually is that you believe that Ripley as a character
cares about her. Well, and I think they did a very good job with that, because they do Ripley, when she shows up in 57 years after, after this comes up, you know, she's given a daughter who has died, so she hasn't had a chance to be a mother.
Exactly.
And so now gets a chance at redemption at that with this character. Now, it's funny, because I remember seeing Aliens for the first time at the age of 14 or 15, actually being really irritated by Newt.
Yes.
And yet, you still buy her, and you still 100% buy Ripley's kind of commitment to saving her, and the fear that you experience through this kind of child's eyes is great.
But I think, you know, I think what you just said is the key to it, is that actually we're invested in Ripley.
Yes.
And then we're invested in Newt because we're invested in Ripley.
Yes.
Because this is something that this character that we want to see come through, that we care about, that we understand has this, you know, that Ripley is fulfilling a need that she has.
Yes.
Is then an object of, you know, is a character is that a, she is a,
exactly.
want to take care of and
exactly.
protect, and would then drive the story, because that character has to now do this thing that, you know, is part of who she is as a character.
Exactly. And I think it's funny, because the flip side, you look at something like A Quiet Place that came out a little bit, you know, obviously a couple months ago now, but I saw a few weeks ago now. And what they did amazingly effectively is they had, you know, this family with these children, and that's that they, the focus is keeping their kids alive.
Yeah.
Which is great. But one of the ways they ramped up the tension there was because they killed the first child of this family, the longest child of this family, in the first 5 minutes of the movie. So talk about upping the stakes.
Mm.
You as the audience suddenly believe, and it's very much, and we talked about this before, but it's very much kind of what Game of Thrones did very effectively, is the, oh my God, they killed Ned Stark.
Yeah.
This means anyone can die, and therefore you have this incredible, if we, you know, when the script is good, the performance is good, you are incredibly invested in this because you don't know what the result is going to be. And that's one of the failings of this Jurassic Park, was you never for a second believe this child is not going to make it.
Yeah.
Because all the heroes make it, and this is what they've set up.
And
it was just kind of aggravating.
In the context of upping the stakes, that's a good point as well, in that I think the more you can make the audience believe that this character or this, you know, object of that's being protected or that's important, you know, is in peril. The more we buy that, the more we're going to go along for that ride, the more we can be, you know, the more we can feel that, you know, there's real stakes and real peril.
Yes.
Then the more we care about that peril happening. It actually ties back into our review and kind of conversation about Solo as well.
Yes.
In that, you know, there again, like, we know that Solo and Chewie and Lando and, you know, the main characters in that all are going to make it. So, you know, there's not a lot of question mark around any of that.
Well,
there's no question mark in it. So it takes
anything.
It actually takes all the tension out, no matter how well the scenes
the rest
are constructed.
Of it's done. Yeah, exactly.
You know, tracking back, you know, another good example of where that's effective is in Jaws.
Right. So that was the one that, you know, we're talking about kind of where we'd seen this the earliest, and, you know, realizing that Jaws was a good example. And the kids aren't dwelt upon there, which is actually kind of good, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it does, for those who don't remember, they, you know, they have the it's not the main character's kids, it's his girlfriends, as his friends. Anyway,
yeah.
You know, the look, the there is the shark floating around killing people on the beaches.
Yeah.
So you guys can go play. You want to play by the beach? That's great. But go in the lagoon because the shark can't make it into the lagoon.
Right.
And so you have this amazingly tense sequence with mm-hmm. these kids playing around in their boat. And then you suddenly realize the shark has got in the lagoon.
Yes.
And it's incredibly tense.
Well, and you know what they do there too, very much so, is they again spend the first 2 minutes of the movie establishing yes. that, you know, you're in the water, you can get eaten.
Exactly. And you know what I realized they did yeah. before that sequence?
Yeah.
And it was this so well done and shows that you can up the tension without spending the time to mm-hmm. develop the character necessarily.
Yes, yeah.
They have a sequence before that with one of the early attacks on the kind of crowded beach.
Yes.
Where you have a mum and her kid and the kid's playing on that's one of those right. inflatable yeah. things. Mm-hmm. And there's a distraction. I think it's the kind of false alarm of the mm-hmm. The kids playing around the water with the fake shark fin.
Yes.
And then you see the mum going crazy and all you see is the Lilo, whatever it is, the inflatable yeah. thing that yeah. she's playing on, floating on the beach, punctured with yeah. a bit of blood around it.
Yeah.
And, oh my God, okay, so yeah. we just killed a 7-year-old child.
Yes.
Yeah.
Once again, no one's safe.
No yeah. one is safe. Yeah. That means any of these people can go at any moment. Yeah. So that when the two kind of hero kids are in, not hero kids, but when the yeah. kind of primary ones are in the lagoon being chased by the shark, you honestly believe that this could go either yeah. way. And that's hugely impactful.
Exactly. Yeah. And then what's an example of where this really doesn't work?
So come back to, I think, our favorite recent whipping boy, Justice League.
Yes, yes.
Yes. So many issues problems, in that movie. Yeah. Good God. But the entirely arbitrary, where do they end up? Estonia or mm-hmm. Bulgaria or somewhere? Come Eastern European.
Yes.
Generic Eastern European yes. something, yes. right? And there was, you know, this factory that becomes the hub of, what's his name? Vortex? No, the main bad guy.
Steppenwolf. Yes.
It's named after a 60s heavy metal band. It's ridiculous. Yes. you know, they have this kind of arbitrary family that's suddenly surrounded by the parademons. And yes. they have to hold them off. And there's a small son and daughter. And oh my God, they're all going to be dead.
Yes.
And so you you know, they fall into that again. Entirely arbitrary.
Yeah.
Family people that you just don't care about, and you know are only there to try and connect some of these visual effects monsters right. to something vaguely real,
or some type. You know, try to. I think that's a good example of manufactured peril, right? So it's like,
oh yeah,
it's the assumption of like, oh, these are kids. We don't want to see kids get hurt, right. so we're going to throw some kids in here to create this sort of idea of danger when right. there's actually really no danger.
With none at all.
And then we really couldn't care.
Irritatingly going to kind of distract half of this battle for the entire yeah. world. You're going to suddenly have the Flash being forced to go and have this kind of comedic escapade right. saving these children. And again, it just doesn't make any sense. Yeah. You just don't care.
Exactly.
And that, you know, Jurassic Park certainly was far superior to that.
Mm.
Apart from anything else, it was a far better constructed and directed movie in many yeah. ways. Mm-hmm. But I think another example of this, exactly, it's kind of manufactured. Manufactured peril. Which just doesn't work and rings yeah. very, very hollow.
Exactly. So what would you say, like, for anyone that's, you know, working on their own project, you know, what would be kind of a key takeaway in your mind as far as, like, how to do this well or how to think about approaching this piece of the pie, a piece of the project?
I think the biggest thing comes down to making sure that I think the Ripley example is a good one, where it's, even if you don't spend time on the if you want to construct tension around a secondary or tertiary character,
yeah.
make the person who you do care about those persons. So yes. make sure that you actually care about your protagonist, and you are then automatically involved with their well-being, and you know that if they will be traumatized by the death or whatever of yeah. this third party, you will then, as an audience member, start to care.
Yeah.
And I think there can be, you know, there's God knows, there's certainly nothing wrong with having a kid be one of the main kind of drivers of that.
Yes.
Obviously, we have that in Dead Town.
Yeah. You
know, our kind of heroine is a 12-year-old girl who's yep. trying to fight her way through this world.
Mm-hmm.
But that felt organic as we were doing it, and I think we play it off with, you know, Chan having lost our hero having lost his own family. He then becomes attached to this child mm-hmm. in a way that is kind of pseudo-parental and allows him access back to his own humanity. And yep. so it's very deliberately thought about. And you've seen, you know, the for spoiler alert, I suppose, for anyone who hasn't read it yet, but the kind of cold open of the show is this kid with her parents, and the parents die.
Yeah.
And so immediately it's like, oh, you know, I feel like, I think we did that, to pat ourselves in the back a second, I think we did that well in terms of setting up this. Thank you. In terms of setting up a character who has already suffered something horrific
yes.
and probably is going to keep doing this because this is the world that they're in.
Yeah.
And I think and then you add, okay, here's this kind of anti-hero that we have that you start to engage with, and therefore he starts to engage with her. Mm-hmm. I think that's when it can work well. And obviously there are a million, you know, looking back at A Quiet Place, that's a very, very effective way of connecting with these characters and what you want them to feel and the challenges of being a parent in that situation
mm-hmm.
and conveying like how as a parent you will step in and protect and save and what you'll do to
yep.
protect and the troubles, the traumas that come along with that.
Yeah,
they did a very good job of setting that up.
Mm-hmm.
For much of there are some other kind of structural issues that movie, I think they did very, very well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think my last thought on that would be to add that I think, you know, fundamentally, and we've talked about this on other shows, but I think fundamentally it all goes back to the characters driving the story. And so the choices that the characters make are the things that, you know, drive the plot and the story forward. And then the stumbling blocks that we as creators put in the way of those yes. characters and then how they react to those stumbling blocks. And so when you give that character something that they care about that is then put into peril, then you have a way, you have a mechanism to kind of wind that yes, character up
exactly.
to then, you know, give them something that you can then put into peril or right. even take away,
mm-hmm.
which then again forces that character to make decisions
exactly.
that then propel the story forward.
And to make good decisions and sometimes bad decisions.
Exactly.
And that's part of it as well. I think allowing, you know, giving your characters genuine humanity and allowing mm-hmm. them to make mistakes and
yep.
get things wrong and, you know, fall back on issues that they've had before that
yep.
they can't quite get
yep.
over. And, you know, all that stuff is obviously, it's so crucial to making them human and accessible.
Yeah.
And allowing, mm-hmm. yeah, I think.
When relatable,
you,
yeah.
Yeah, relatable yeah. you to see yourself in that. So, yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, so do that.
Yes, right, exactly.
So Adam, I have a question for you. What is a hoojama flip? I think I've heard that term a couple of times.
I think we've heard that once yeah. or twice. Yeah. So yes, the hoojama flip is simply, you know, that thing that you can't quite remember, but is kind of you and McKenna liking.
Mm.
At the board, yes. you know, that thing that's on the tip of your tongue, but you can't quite focus
that
on right
thing,
now.
Yeah. So yes. for us, it's, you know, we end the show with our hoojama flip of the week, which is sort of the thing we're thinking about or top of mind.
Mm-hmm,
So for me, one of the things I've been doing, I'll just say, you know, part of what we've been doing as a company recently is, you know, just continuing to experiment with the whole, you know, kind of engaging with an audience, building our audience, you know, as we're building these projects out and continuing to develop the app and bringing more creators on board and
mm-hmm.
building out this stuff for Yarn, all these things that we've been talking about and that are doing, you know, one of the things that we realized is like we need and we want to, you know, have a more direct conversation and dialogue with the people that are consuming these things.
Yes.
And so one of the things that I've been doing is, you know, spending a bit more time, you know, playing around with and chatting with people on Instagram specifically, but in social media mm-hmm. in general. And so, you know, I haven't spent a lot of time over the past, you know, really couple of years doing a lot of drawing. We've been doing a lot of writing. We've been
right.
doing a lot of creating. We've been doing a lot of other stuff. But that thing, which for me used to be the majority of what
right,
I spent my
course,
time doing,
yep.
Haven't been doing a lot of. And so I've actually found over the past couple of months a, you know, very kind of fun way for me to have some of that engagement and to kind of continue to interact with and build around, you know, the audience that we want to be engaged with. You know, participate in some of the stuff that is going on Instagram, and some of that's been a lot of fun. So like in May, Every year in May, there's a, you know, hashtag mermaid thing which goes on. So, you know, different people drawing their own versions of different mermaids. And so you kind of hashtag it mermaid, and then anyone can go and search that hashtag and see all the different types of mermaids that people are drawing. And so I did a couple of those this past May. And then I just found a new thing.
I wonder why you started drawing mermaids suddenly. That's funny.
That's why. So there's, you know, there's one in October called Inktober, which is, you know, you do a daily drawing in ink and then hashtag it Inktober. And that one was started by Jake Parker, who I'm a fan of as well. So, you know, these different kind of things kind of take off and become these sort of collective, you know, group art projects, which is pretty cool to see. And even, you know, for me, kind of more fun to engage with whenever I can. So I just came across this new one, which seems to be taking off, and have now done one finished one, and I'm having the sketch stage of a second one. And it's hashtag draw this in your style. And so at this point, I'm not sure who started it, but it's a very cool idea. So essentially, you draw a picture of a character. Generally, what I've seen is sort of like bust, you know, head sketch to bust, you know, characters, and then hashtag it, you know, draw this in your style. And then, you know, basically a bunch of different people will take that as the source material and do their own interpretation of that character. And so I've seen ones that range from very faithful as far as the look and feel of the character, just drawn in a different person's style, all the way to, you know, kind of gender reversals to, you know, completely, you know, taking a lot of artistic license. It's just very fun to see, you know, what people's interpretations of that source material is.
Yes.
And so I've done one so far, which you can go see at M2 Eben, which is my personal Instagram page. I'm in the middle of doing another one. And then I think I'm going to actually post my own version of that just to see what anyone will interpret from that as well, just for the fun of it. So, nice. So check that out on Instagram if that sounds interesting to you. It's actually a lot of fun just to see what everybody's doing, even if it's not something that you yourself will do. But again, that's hashtag draw this in your style. So check that out.
Fun stuff. Very nice.
Yeah.
Very cool, dude. Mine is actually funny. I think last week I did a production related thing as well, because certainly this last episode has been all-consuming,
last episode of Future Man has been very engaging,
but as is fun, you know, always, even having been doing this for 20 years, they're still kind of constantly reminded that the you know, work very hard, but still the fun of doing the work and rediscovering things as we go. And actually, what something that hit me last week that we ended up using a number of times was the French over that I had almost, it's funny, it's been a while since I've been around the set that used it. And
so explain.
I don't know how effective it was. So yeah. So no, it's, you know, so you have, again, looking at the kind of two of us talking here, as it were, as an example, you know, if we're, your kind of traditional coverage is, you know, two shot here and then kind of this direction. So you're getting your full frontal.
So hold on. Backing up for 1 second. So we're videoing this for Instagram.
Yes.
TV.
Sorry. So if you're on the podcast,
there's also an audio version.
No idea what we're talking about. I'm gesticulating wildly for Instagram. And now I'm looking at the podcast page as if that's going to give me some inspiration.
So explain once again. So essentially, audio only.
Exactly. So, you know, if you have two people sitting on a sofa, as we are doing, you have your traditional coverage, your kind of two shot, which is just a straight frontal, you know, holding us both and left to right in the frame. And then you have your overs, which are the kind of coverage as we're talking to each other, which is kind of over, you know, shooting the camera as we're to my right. So to
looking past Adam
to Eben, and looking past Eben to Adam, to me. Anyway, so then the other way of playing that same scene is to do what's called the French over, which is, I don't know why, I don't know the derivation of that. I don't know why, I imagine French cinema started doing it first. You know, where actually, as opposed to being on the faces, you are over our backs. So essentially you're kind of catching, you know, you're shooting across my shoulders onto Eben and shooting across Eben's shoulders onto me. And it means you get this, you're getting this actually only kind of quarter view of a face, which depending on what the scene is can become incredibly effective. Yeah. And if the characters are trying to dissemble, or they're trying to hide something from each other, or they're not connecting as you think they should be,
yeah,
the French Over can be a very effective way of kind of visually illustrating that.
Yes.
And so it doesn't mean that your kind of master can even still be from the front, but if you're the bulk of the coverage then happens in that style, you get this sense of separation there.
Yes.
That can be very effective and can be very good. And we used it a few times. It's also, depending on how the scenes are structured and what you're shooting, it can be a way of kind of reducing the amount of coverage you need, which can become important if you're running up against time constraints on sets and things like that.
When you're doing 57 setups.
When you're doing lots of, exactly. or you have, pages and pages of dialogue to fill.
Yes.
And only so much time to do it.
Yes.
It can be very useful. But, as a creative tool, I was just reminded of how much I like it as a visual style.
Yeah.
I think it was funny because I was kind of reminded of it this week very clearly because we used it a few times and the director, I think, was terrific and did a great job of doing that.
Well, I love that as a just kind of a reminder and a reference point for, again, kind of going back to fundamental storytelling, which is, the notion that, using, and this is what you should be doing anyway, but it's like using the shot selection as a storytelling mechanism.
Exactly.
So it's sometimes easy to, it can be, I think, easy to forget, yet important to remember, whether it's a drawing in a comic or, again, a shot with a camera, that, every shot selection or every angle that you're choosing, can be used as a tool to reinforce the point of that particular story or that particular, feeling or tone that is being communicated.
Exactly.
And that actually, doing that French over versus a traditional over can have an incredibly different effect.
Could result in the scene having a very different effect.
Exactly.
Yeah. There's this great series on YouTube called Every Frame a Painting. And there's a whole lot of different movies and they cover everything from, they did like a great episode on Bayhem and why Michael Bay's action sequences work so well, and they look at other ones who are trying to copy them, or they'll do interrogation, or they'll do card, like all these different things. And they did a great one on using Silence of the Lambs and the conversational pieces between Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins, between Starling and Hannibal Lecter, and how camera placement and blocking of the actors and how much of the face you're seeing versus not, how much is being blocked, but how that is conveying the kind of shifts in power within the scene between these two characters and what that conveys. It was kind of brilliant. One of those movies that is incredibly effective and incredibly good, and then really digging in and breaking down why it works so well, quite aside from the obviously incredible quality of script and acting, is the directorial choices made.
Yeah.
And Jonathan Demme did such a good job with that.
And to me, people direct things in all kinds of different ways and all kinds of different mediums. But I will say, to me, that's the stuff that I get really excited about, because it's like there's a part of directing which is about getting a great performance from an actor, which of course is crucially important, but there's the visual piece of it, which is not just about creating a pretty frame, but is about, subtly in some cases, or in some cases overtly, actually, telling the story in pure visual terms, which is, just so very cool.
And you look at a film like Dunkirk, where obviously the script probably took all Mad Max, my God, the script, like the written words that are actually spoken on a page would be 20 pages of a Mad Max, a 2-hour movie.
Yeah.
But still amazingly effective in terms of, conveying not quite a sign from the action, just conveying who these characters are and what they're doing and why they're doing it.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Great stuff.
Great stuff. Yes. Yeah. So do that too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
So to wrap up again, episode 45.
Yep. Hooray.
This will go up in the next day or so. The video version will go up in the next day or so as well.
Yep.
So if you're interested in seeing what we look like talking about all this stuff, check out our Instagram TV channel.
I do feel like if you're, listening to this, there should be a caveat there, which we're not very pretty.
So, speak for yourself, sir. But yes.
But we have
dogs. We do have dogs on the left and right of us. So yeah, so Instagram TV at M2 Action on Instagram, at M2 Action basically everywhere. Mm-hmm. So Facebook, yep. Instagram,
all over the place.
All those places. You can also, and please do check out our comics app, Macroverse. And you can also see what that looks like on social media at Macroverse app. But mm-hmm. more importantly, go download Macroverse from the App Store, yes. or from Google Play.
Take a look. Leave reviews.
Give us reviews. There's also a place within the app to send us feedback. We desperately want your feedback. So, you know, we're still very much in the phase of development where, and we probably always will be, but we right now especially want people to, you know, give us your thoughts on, you know, what's working for you. What do you love? What do you think we could do better? Like, we want all of that feedback. We're building this for you as well as for us.
Yes.
So that piece of it is actually very legitimately important to us. And finally, I just want to always give a shout out to Brandon Weisel, who's our long-term composer and who also created the intro and outro for this show.
Hooray.
So thank you, Brandon. And we will be back next week.
Next week. Indeed.
Cheers.
Bye.